This is the Quality News Network. On Wall Street today, there was another sell-off. We'll have the closing numbers for you later in our newscast. In Iraq today, President Bush made a...
Good afternoon. Due to unavoidable circumstances, today's broadcasts on the Head-On Radio Network are going to be repeats of broadcasts from last week. This first broadcast is a broadcast of Bruce Birch's show from Tuesday of last week from the Take Back America Conference, and the Bob Kincaid show, which will follow, will be a repeat of his Wednesday show. Thank you very much. Enjoy the shows.
Oil-rich northern city of Kirkuk today, five car bombs have killed 18 people and wounded dozens. At least 20 other Iraqis were killed in violence today. In Baghdad, at Saddam Hussein's trial, the chief judge declared an end to hearing defense witnesses. He says the prosecution will present its closing argument next week. In Washington, the House has approved a $94.5 billion bill to fund the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, as well as rebuild the Gulf Coast from last year's hurricane damage. A hurricane warning issued for Florida's Gulf Coast has been downgraded to a tropical storm warning, but Alberto is still hitting Florida with heavy rains and wind. There has been some minor damage reported. In Washington, White House advisor Karl Rove has been told by the special counsel that he does not expect to charge him in the CIA leak case. Rove had testified five times before the grand jury. In Vienna, China and Russia are refusing to join the other world powers in threatening Iran with sanctions if the country doesn't suspend its uranium enrichment program. In Jerusalem, Israeli military sources say that the explosion that killed seven people last Friday on a Gaza beach was caused by explosives planted there by Palestinian militants. They say it was not the result of artillery fire from an Israeli gunboat, as earlier thought. Also today in the Gaza Strip, an Israeli airstrike reportedly killed 11 Palestinians. A militant in a van carrying rockets was said to be the target of that attack. In Washington, the United States officially recognized Montenegro, which broke away from its union with Serbia. A majority of the citizens there voted in a referendum in May to declare their independence. In May, wholesale prices rose more than analysts expected. The Labor Department report is seen by many as a sign that inflation is heating up. You're listening to the Quality News Network.
Most people would rather have root canal than go to a dealer to buy a car. But you can turn dread into joy when you learn how to play the car buying game. Read the book, Right Car, Right Price, and you'll discover how the game is played and how you can win every time. Whether you're buying a car or a truck, new or used, Right Car, Right Price explains how to find and buy the vehicle best suited to your individual transportation needs. Auto Week called Right Car, Right Price the right stuff. So take the hassle out of car buying. Read Right Car, Right Price, and every time you get into your new car, you'll know you've got a great deal. Go online to rightcarrightprice.com to order your copy today. It only takes an hour to read Right Car, Right Price, and it just costs $10. We even pay the postage. So go to rightcarrightprice.com right now. It'll be one of the best decisions you ever make.
Consumer electronics retailer Best Buy reports its quarterly profit was up 38%. The higher-than-expected amount was driven by sales of flat-screen televisions and cost controls. The world's largest provider of free email, Yahoo, says it has now contained a software virus that infected a very small fraction of its more than 200 million accounts. Video rental chain Blockbuster is fighting back in the antitrust suit filed by rival Netflix, the online DVD rental company. Blockbuster says in a countersuit that the lawsuit is based on unenforceable patents that were obtained deceptively. A U.S. consumer group is suing the owner of the KFC chain to try to force it to stop using trans fat and switch to a healthier cooking oil. Researchers report that drinking coffee cuts the risk of cirrhosis of the liver from alcohol by 22% per cup each day. However, they stop short of saying that doctors should prescribe coffee for that reason. General Motors is breaking ground today on its first fully owned plant in Russia. GM is the latest in a series of foreign car plants in that country. The AFL-CIO plans to invest $1 billion in New Orleans to develop 10,000 affordable homes and a new downtown motel. Light sweet crude settled at $68.56 a barrel today, and at the close of Wall Street, the Dow was down 86 points. The Nasdaq was down 19 points. There's more at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Ali Dramov.
Roll up your sleeves and put on your gloves, because the work is just beginning.
Monday warrior, me's right. Today's Tom Sawyer,
it's time to turn the conversation to taking back America. From the crusaders who have drained our treasury, created needless wars, and expect the working people to pay for their billionaires' games, it's time for the Bruce Birch Radio Program. Brought to you by the West Virginia Council of Carpenters and Millwrights. They are building the American dream each and every day. You can get in on the program by dialing in to 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. And now, your host, Bruce Birch.
And you're back. This is Bruce Birch, and we're live here at the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C. at the Washington Hilton. What a fantastic conference it's been. You just heard Guy James live here on Radio Row and some of the wonderful interviews that he's had here. We have several interviews lined up this afternoon. We have, to start off with, we have Susan Turnbull, who will be on in just a few minutes. We also have an Iraqi veteran who will be here to talk with us about some of the things that are going on over in that part of the world. Jody Thompson, who is the co-founder of Culture RX, which is a human resources management company, and they have developed a new system of human resources management that should be interesting to talk about. We also have Greg Spector with us later on this afternoon, and Spencer Overton, David Bryden to finish out the guest list this evening. But to start with, we do have Susie Turnbull, who is the but before we get into the interview with her, the first thing I would like to do is just sort of give you all a heads up. If you'd like to chat while you're listening to this radio program this afternoon, you can go to the headonradionetwork.com chat room, and that's at headonradionetwork.com. If you'd like to partake in the blog posting of this afternoon, you can go to my website, brucebirch.com. You can also send me an email to bruce@brucebirch.com. to give me a heads up on what you're thinking about the programming this evening and this afternoon. First of all, today we got down here and got loaded into and unloaded and hooked up, and everything's been working fine. And live with us right now here on Radio Row here at the Take Back America Conference, we have none other than the vice chair of the Democratic National Committee. I feel so fortunate to have you on the radio with me this afternoon, Susie Turnbull.
In fact, Bruce, it is my honor to be with you.
Okay, well, thanks so much. There's a lot of questions out there that have been swirling around today about some of the latest developments in Washington. You know what I'm referring to, perhaps. The situation with the president's closest advisor. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, basically, my thoughts pretty much parrot and echo what Senator Schumer said today,
okay,
which is, number one, there was a leak. Someone leaked information and compromised our national security, and we still don't have an indictment for that leak.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that is a problem, and I think that that's something that really needs investigation, and that the president knows full well that his chief advisor shouldn't be there anymore.
He shouldn't.
He should not be there, and he should not have security clearance.
that now, I just by going online and you know, there was a big flap over the website truthout.org that they had reported that he was indicted, and they're actually still standing by their story. Jason Leopold, as of about 2 hours ago, went on Raw Story and basically said that, yes, indeed, they are standing by their story, and that and also the publisher is also standing by their story, saying that they believe it may be a sealed indictment. So well, I think that's kind of interesting. But
I think that's very interesting. I have not heard that. Mm-hmm. I actually just checked my email, and I didn't see that from Truth Out.
Really?
And I find it... if it's a sealed indictment, then for sure, even more to the point, that this man should not be sitting in the White House.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, and then the other thing about it is that over the last few weeks, last few months, Karl Rove's position in the White House has changed. And his total position is a political position where he's supposed to be reelecting members of Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And quite honestly, I don't think that our government should be funding someone whose job is to reelect our Congress. Taxpayer dollars should not be going towards that.
I totally agree. They should have a think tank do that instead, I think. One of the many thousands and thousands of this thing, you know. Anyway. But it's really good to have you here today. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about is, first of all, tell me what the strategy is for this fall. Do you guys have a direct national strategy for electing folks this fall, or what's going on in that area?
Well, our strategy is a simple one. First of all, you're not going to win if people don't come out to vote, and our goal is to get as many people out to vote as possible. We know that across this country right now, people are upset and want change, and our goal is to capitalize on that. But we're going to do that by offering a bold agenda, a vision for the future, and that vision is together America can do better. Together we're going to have a government that is honest and open to its people, and it's honest and open to its to the military, too. For example, we will never have another war where troops are led into battle without the proper armor, without the proper information, and based on faulty intelligence. That's number one. I mean, we want real security. Everyone across this country saw how our homeland security is at risk when we saw Katrina and the incompetence of this government. And what we're saying is, first thing we want done is to implement the recommendations of the 911 Commission. So if you have honest and open government where you don't have lobbyists writing the laws, like the energy bill, mm-hmm. and the drugs and the insurance companies, mm-hmm. running the Medicare prescription drug bill, and you have security through the implementation of the 911 Commission, to have real security, not where you have your ports and your chemical plants and your nuclear plants secure, that is a change, and that's a future. And it's a future based on hope and not just on fear.
And I think that that's absolutely... exactly what we're looking for. I remember when Bill Clinton was elected back, in 92, and his platform was all about hope. It was all about hope and raising people up. And what we've seen now is that we have a society that's based primarily in fear, with the various levels of terror colors to look at and all of the,
Yeah, and I think people don't buy it anymore.
Right.
I think they're looking at President Bush and saying he's like the boy who cried wolf. Hey, there's a problem, there's a problem, there's a problem. And which is why, despite the fact that the poll showed some minor change this week on their views on the Iraq war after the assassination,
mm-hmm.
What, in fact, the case is that those numbers are going to drop again, and that people don't just buy it. They don't buy that there is a plan. They don't look at PR stunts like today's flight into Iraq as something that is really making a difference.
Mm-hmm.
What's going to make a difference is when the Iraqi government takes control and our guys come home. That's what's going to make a difference.
The current resident, I really disdain calling him president. The current resident, 1600 West Pennsylvania Avenue, has pretty much made it very clear that his intention is to pass the Iraq situation off to whoever is next. Should a Democrat absolutely get elected, is there a plan in place, or is there an idea about how to extract ourselves or to help stabilize the country and then remove ourselves to allow them to be self-governing?
Well, I think, first of all, the Democratic candidates out there today are saying it is unacceptable to think that this is going to be passed on to the next president, that the end of 2008, the beginning of 2009 is way too late. Mm-hmm. 2006 should be a year of transition. We should start our pullout now. We should make it clear to the Iraqi people that that is the plan, and that we should bring our allies back into this so that we can, in fact, help support the Iraqi government and help support a democracy. But no way, no how should this go on to 2009.
So, when John Kerry was running for president in 2004, one of the things that he was saying was that we needed to up troop levels. Is that still, are there still some of the major leaders who are still thinking along those lines to stabilize the country?
I haven't heard that.
Oh, okay.
I heard that, as a matter of fact, John Kerry made some news today here at the Campaign for America's Future Take Back America conference when he stated pretty clearly that he regretted his vote for this war, and that his vote was based on faulty intelligence.
It's refreshing to hear someone take responsibility for their actions. I mean, and that's not dissing John Kerry at all. It's just that we have, on the Republican side, when they do something that they know they made a mistake, they just move forward and keep bulldozing as if nothing happened. And no one seems to want to take responsibility for the things that have happened.
Well, that's been one of the big key problems with this administration, because there's been no accountability.
Mm-hmm.
There's been no reflection on the fact that the kinds of mistakes, the kind of bad attitude and approach to dealing with with Katrina is something that should have been recognized. And I think that was a turning point in this country where people of all political persuasion looked at this and said, this is wrong, we can do better. Our country deserves a government that cares about its people and can do better.
Katrina, it really amazed me. I was talking with someone here yesterday, and one of the things that we were discussing was that was a perfect opportunity for a new WPA, for a new New Deal kind of situation, where the folks who live down there could have been a major part of the rebuilding process, could have participated in a large way to try to recreate their community that was just completely decimated. And yet what we see today is government contractors who are hiring undocumented workers to rebuild New Orleans. And it's really...
We are finding... Also, non-bid contracts.
And non-bid contracts, exactly.
Non-bid contracts. And I can tell you, I was in New Orleans about a month ago.
Mm-hmm.
There are cars sitting underneath the overpasses that will never be driven again because obviously the water destroyed them. They could be used for scrap metal. They haven't even been picked up. And it's those kinds of things that you look at and go, what's wrong with this picture? Where miles and miles of devastation still exist, and you don't have a sense that there's things that are being done. One of the biggest problems that President Bush has brought to this government and brought to our country has been a lack of asking and respecting the American people to do for ourselves. And he didn't do that. And Mark Warner, former Governor Mark Warner, is talking about this these days. And I think he's absolutely right. After 9/11, what did President Bush say? Come to New York and shop. Okay? Well, and after Katrina, exactly what you said. Was there ever an approach to say, let's do this ourselves. We can do this. There was a constant reliance on the American Red Cross, period.
A privatization of a relief effort that should have been government-led completely. I think it amazed me that they turned ice trucks around, and yet Walmart was right there on the spot with trucks of water. I don't think there was any mistake in that.
Absolutely. And I think in addition to that, when you look at it, what this president has done has been to strip government of its ability to provide services. The response is always, we don't have enough money, we don't have enough opportunity, we can't do that. And it's because of this war that which is hemorrhaging money every day, and it is because of their goal, really, is to strip the government.
It really is, you know, and that's an interesting line of conversation, because the more I look at what they're doing, the more it looks as if there's two things going on. The first thing is to deregulate government out of existence, and the second thing is to drain the treasury. And it seems as if both are going on simultaneously, and when the time does come that a check and balance is back in the government, i.e. the Democratic Party, what's there going to be left? I mean, we're going to be left cleaning up a huge mess. And that's troubling to me because my children are going to be the ones paying for it all.
Exactly. We were left a mess when Bill Clinton became president. Mm-hmm. He turned it around, and this president has created a much, much bigger mess,
mm-hmm.
a much bigger mess with deficits that are going to be affecting our children and our children's children. And every child being born today is born with a debt on his back or her back. And I think that in itself is there's a word in Yiddish. It's called shanda. It's a shanda, which is a shame.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's what we're seeing right now.
I'm talking with Susie Turnbull, who is the vice chair of the Democratic National Committee, and very fortunate to have her on, the first guest today, high power guest. I do have, right after you're on, an Iraqi veteran. Who has been there and has come back. You know, if there were one thing that you, as the vice chair of the Democratic National Committee, could say to the troops that are in Iraq right now, what would it be?
We're with you guys. We're with you, and we respect you. We respect the job that you're doing and the commitment that you've put forth for the American people. But what we also want you to know is that we promise that when we're in charge, you're going to have the armor that you need, you're going to have the equipment that you're required, and you're not going to be sent places where faulty intelligence has pushed you there.
How did the Republicans turn around and take away the idea that, I mean, or create the idea that we were soft on security and that? I have yet to understand how that happened.
I think they're wrong. I mean, and I have no idea how that happened, because in fact, if you look at it, we have an administration where there is not a single, neither the president nor the vice president, ever served outside this country. They didn't serve in a war. And for them to question the credentials as they did of someone like John Murtha, who was a 31-year Marine, or a John Kerry, who served with honor, is pretty remarkable. And I think that what we want to say for the future is honesty, openness in government, and real security. Real security, which starts in the hometown security. We're not going to take cops off the streets, which is what they have done over their administration. We are going to make sure that our first responders have everything that they need. And we're also going to look at Homeland Security funds distributed in a way that makes sense. When you take the money away from Washington and New York and put it in places where the likelihood of a terrorist attack are zero to none, I think that in itself says it all.
Final message to the American public about the Democratic strategy.
The Democratic strategy is a strategy where we're going to be contesting every seat across this country, because we understand and respect the American people to know the difference between politics and policy, and that we'll bring forth a policy that will be better for the American people.
Do you think the South is winnable?
I think the South is winnable. We've been winning races in Mississippi recently, in the legislature, in open seats. The Mobile, Alabama, has the first African-American mayor since Reconstruction, I believe.
Wow.
Yep. And we're going to take it back. We've won seats in Missouri, which is not exactly the South, but it's pretty close. And we're going to do it by making sure that people know the difference. They know the difference between real security and politics. They know the difference between educational opportunity mm-hmm. and talking heads. And they know the difference between being honest and straightforward to the American people.
Susie Turnbull, thank you so much for joining me today. It's really an honor and a privilege to have you on our radio program, and certainly hope we can have you on again sometime soon.
I'd love to be with you, Bruce. Okay. Thanks so much.
Thank you. And that was Susie Turnbull, who is the vice chair of the Democratic National Committee. We're going to go ahead and take a very quick break, and we're going to come back. This is the Bruce Birch Radio Program being brought to you by the Head On Radio Network.
Closer to the heart.
The Head On Radio Network is brought to you every night by the Carpenters and Millwrights. The Mid-Atlantic Regional Council of Carpenters is a portion of the United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Joiners of America, or more commonly called the Carpenters Union. The millwrights are a very specialized craft that perform their work with highly sensitive equipment and perform much of their work on machinery like turbines, laser alignment, and other highly specialized tools. We would like to thank the Carpenters and Millwrights for their support, because freedom of speech is free, and it's brought to you by the Carpenters and Millwrights, working hard every day to provide a brighter future. Thank you from the Head On Radio Network.
When Bruce and I filled in for Bob Kincaid, we didn't know what to expect, but we sure didn't expect a call from the decider.
Told Walmart to sell the Easter egg dye kits, you know, the ones with the resurrection egg, we decided at Camp David that we were going to support Walmart and go with what the Lord told them and buy some of them resurrection egg kits, and you know, I found the resurrection egg. God spoke to me through that egg, and God told me that I am the fourth member of the Holy Trinity. We're calling it the Holy Quadraphonic. And so now I'm the fourth voice of the Holy Trinity. So now I've got four voices in my head. I have the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost and the Decider. I'm the Decider. I get to decide.
Don't miss Head On with Bob Kincaid weekdays 7 to 10 p.m. and Fourth Estate Radio with John Fox and Bruce Birch Saturdays 10 p.m. Eastern Time on the Head On Radio Network.
There's one place on the web you can go that's so topical you can apply it liberally. WD40.com. WDYAD40.com. Claude, Wally, and Dookie are there. They're working hard every day to give you updates in news, politics, and a great sense of humor. Just stop on by and see the boys at WD40.com, a place where you can raise your voice and be heard. WD40.com. Your one-stop shop for all things progressive.
Okay, listen up. If you're sick of hearing lies by right-wing corporate pukes who like to pretend they stand up for the working guy, then head over to the Cup of Joe radio show, where the truth will hit you so hard you'll have to wear your hard hat. You can listen to the screaming audio at cupojoe.blogspot.com. That's cupojoe.blogspot.com. Now get back to work.
We'll be right back.
Bruce Birch, and we're here at the Take Back America conference, being sponsored here in Washington D.C. by the our our future. Anyway, you can go to ourfuture.org and check that out if you're interested in checking out that conference. Just a huge amount of wonderful speakers here today, and people milling about. A little while ago, I ran into Wayne Madsen of the Wayne Madsen Report, and he will be getting on the radio program with us sometime probably in the next few weeks. He gave me a copy of his book, and very impressive book. I do want to, at this point, introduce to you Richard Murphy. And Richard is an Iraqi veteran who is back here from Iraq. Richard served there and served actually at Abu Ghraib for 6 months. Worked logistical security support for around Halliburton and Kellogg Brown and Root. And as he says here, his mom ended up having to buy his body armor. Now, we were just talking to Susan Turnbull, who was the vice chair of the Democratic National Committee, who said if there was one thing that she could tell the Iraqi troops is that we're going to bring you home safe, and we're also going to create the opportunities so that you guys have the body armor you need and the tools necessary to do the job right. Richard, welcome to the program.
It's great to be here.
Tell me a little bit about, what it was like going into Iraq. When you first got there, what was your impressions of what was going on? Now, were you part of the invasion force? Or
we got in country in May 2003, so it was after the end of major combat operations,
okay,
quote unquote.
So 2 months after the war started, after major, we have to. What was the mission accomplished? That was the thing that the resident, said. Tell me. So you got into Iraq in May 2003. Major combat operations were supposedly over. You said in quotes. What did that mean?
Well, obviously, major combat operations were not over then, and in fact, major combat operations have continued. Taking back Fallujah, taking Najaf, were probably the biggest operations since the very beginning of the war.
Really?
But when I did first get into the country, I saw a lot of goodwill among the Iraqi people. It seemed I saw a lot of optimism among, especially the Shia in the south.
Mm-hmm.
But it seemed each month I was there 15 months, each month was worse than the month before it, as
really?
Far as the insurgency and just seeing that very little reconstruction was going on.
Have you seen the veteran that I talked to yesterday, who just walked by us, as a matter of fact, mentioned to me that he felt like there was a correlation between how the troops were treating the locals there and how and attacks on certain divisions. Do you think that there was any correlation with that, or
that's an interesting. I've never heard that analogy. The sad thing I found in my 15 months was when we first got there, there's a lot more interaction between the American soldiers and the local population. By the time I left, most of the Americans had been confined to certain bases in Iraq, and interaction between the soldiers and the civilians was curtailed.
Now, so how long were you there before you ended up having to go and do a tour of duty in Abu Ghraib?
I've been there for 6 months. We trained Iraqi police in Al-Hilla, Babylon area, and we conducted patrols. We raided houses looking for bad guys, insurgents.
What was it like there in Abu Ghraib?
Well, Abu Ghraib prison. It was shocking to see these thousands and thousands of prisoners living in pretty squalid conditions, and being a part of that, and realizing that it was a perfect example of how overstretched our troops are. Because, I mean, me, for instance, I'm one guy, and I'm not Chuck Norris, I'm not Jean-Claude Van Damme. I was in charge of 320 prisoners.
Wow.
You know, and we were not allowed to have weapons inside the prison. So, you know, you do the math.
How did you, what was the method of control of that many prisoners?
I was just very respectful. Uh-huh. That was the main thing that got me through it. Every day I would say, I respect each of you as a man. They pretty much returned that respect to me.
Did you know Susie or did you know Lindy England and Charles Grainer?
Yes, sir.
When they were there?
Yes, sir.
You know, was there any indication that they were doing some of the things they were doing? I mean, was it public knowledge, or was that something they were just sort of like doing on the sly? Or,
I mean, I didn't know about it, and if I had known about it, I would have certainly turned them in as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. There would have been a long line of us if we had known about it. To turn them in. But nonetheless, I mean, Charles Grainer had a pretty bad reputation as being a bit of a rogue.
Really?
He should not have been put in charge of, you know, that high security wing of the prison.
And that's what that was? That was like a maximum security wing of the prison where they were working?
It was, sure, it was the most isolated place of Abu Ghraib prison.
Give me a mental picture, if you can paint a mental picture, of what the prison looked like, or, you know, like the wings or whatever. I mean, you know, just sort of, you know, so I can see or I can hear what you're saying.
Ironically, you can actually go on Google Earth and look at it.
Okay.
From satellites. But
you can't see Dick Cheney's house. Okay, but anyway.
Interesting. Well, there's camps outside that house thousands of prisoners, and they're in tents.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all out in the open. And then there's a site called the Hard Site, which is a big concrete building that the Iraqis used to use for their own prisoners. And in there, it's got different cell blocks. There's like seven cell blocks.
Mm-hmm.
And cell block one, where all the abuses occurred, is the most isolated area, where each prisoner is pretty much in an individual cell.
So there weren't, as far as any of the other sections of the prison, there wasn't any kind of abuse that happened?
There may have been. I never witnessed any kind of abuse, and the other areas of the prison were so much more open. You know, people going through all the time. I don't think they were as conducive to that sort of abuse.
Did you? Were you commanding? I mean, were you a guy guarding prisoners, or were you actually in charge of some soldiers there? Or?
I was in charge of some Iraqi prison guards.
Okay.
And they turned out to be a lot of more trouble than they were worth.
Really?
Oftentimes.
How so?
Well, they smuggled weapons in one time and actually shot one of our prison guards. It's in the Taguba report.
Okay.
They would bring in contraband for the prisoners. They would bring in drugs, anything they needed.
Wow. So they saw their loyalty more with their countrymen than with the security in that regard.
Their loyalty was to kind of lining their pockets more than anything else.
You think
else.
So? Okay. Now you also caused you to get transferred out of there?
Well, the scandal occurred. The investigation, you know, happened, and we actually thought we were going to go home. We had done a year in Iraq, and we came down to Kuwait. And we were maybe two or three days from leaving, and a colonel came and visited us and told us we were going to go back up north because we had just been extended.
What was the sentiment of the guys, as far as the soldiers, about the war and the occupation? What was the sentiment of the guys who were working within the prison there?
People, I mean, civilians, I think, in the United States have a tough time understanding like the mentality of a soldier, but I think primarily you're there for your unit.
Mm-hmm.
For your buddies, for your squad, your team, your platoon, the very low-level, very small, tight-knit units. And you handle your work and your missions on a kind of day-to-day mentality. People don't really think about the bigger picture as often as you might think.
Or is that something that's ingrained during boot camp? Or?
Sure,
yeah.
And you know, Just to do these kinds of missions, you have to feel safe that your buddy's going to have your back. And I always felt that way.
Even if you're being directed to do something that you, at the moment, you know, you're feeling like this may not be the right thing to do, you still sort of have to carry forward. And
You don't have an obligation to follow orders that you think are illegal or immoral,
uh-huh.
and that is also ingrained in you in basic training.
Did you ever run into any of the situations when you were in Iraq?
I did some missions with Charles Grainer,
mm-hmm.
Where we were transporting prisoners from Abu Ghraib down to Basra, and he was definitely overly rough with the prisoners, and I had to tell him to calm down a few times,
mm-hmm.
because he just seemed to have a lot of joy in humiliating them.
Really?
Any chance he got.
That's just very disturbing. I mean, it makes you wonder what... now, he was, I think he was actually... I read an article on him, and I think he was actually a prison guard here before he went over there, which makes you wonder how he's treating the prisoners here, you know?
And he had a very bad record here as well.
Is he now in prison?
Or 10 years.
10 years.
Fort Leavenworth.
Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. Wow. In Lindy, England?
Yep. 1 year, I believe, in Fort Leavenworth.
Really? I wonder why was the sentence less for her, do you know?
She was a private, and he was a corporal, so it's a little bit higher ranking.
Okay. Now, you also worked convoys with Halliburton and Kellogg Brown and Root. How did it feel being a military guy working a convoy? Now, and we'll get to some of the Blackwater stuff in a minute, but how did it feel working security with these guys? How did they treat you guys?
Well, they always would find a way to mention how much money they were making, and I believe their salaries began at $70,000, tax-free, and then they all pretty much cheated on their overtime, which was commonplace. Pretty much every driver I knew cheated on their overtime, and they were making upwards of $100,000 a year, tax-free. And
you guys are making, I don't want to ask what you were personally making, but you guys average were making?
I was making about $20,000.
Wow.
As a specialist.
So, that makes no sense to me at all whatsoever. You're the guys who are supposed to be keeping them safe. You should be paid more than they were.
And they could leave the combat zone anytime they felt like it. And, they were out of shape. They were unarmed. And I looked at them as a liability.
Were they permitted to carry weapons?
No.
They were not permitted to carry weapons. Their role over there was more transport and logistics, right? What kinds of things were they transporting?
They were transporting very important supplies, like fuel, diesel fuel, food, mm-hmm. ammunition, mm-hmm. anything we needed to transport up through Baghdad, Fallujah, Balad.
Doesn't the U.S. government have, doesn't the Army have trucks too?
They do, but most of the truck drivers are members of the reserves,
uh-huh.
and a lot of the reserve units are just overstretched and worn out.
And is that indicative across the board in the Army and the National Guard at this point?
Pretty much.
Really?
We've been overstretched.
Following along that line of reasoning, how likely do you think it is that we could fight a war in Iran at this point as well without instituting a draft?
I can't even fathom that we'd be capable of doing
really?
Something like that.
I always wondered about Halliburton because I didn't see, looking back across history, I have not seen the same level of private involvement in World War II, in Korea, or in Vietnam. This is the first time that we've really seen this huge upswing in privatization of our military forces. And the other thing that really kind of, that I wanted to ask you about before we, get to some of the other things is, did you ever have any involvement or did you run into any Blackwater security folks while you were there?
From time to time. They walked around kind of like cowboys out
really?
There. You'd see them and they always had better vehicles than us. And, they just operated by their own rules, I think.
What was their role?
They did a lot of security.
For whoever?
Whoever. Yeah, it's hard to, it was hard to tell. They were around. I think they guarded a lot of the pipelines. And
so you guys were there So you guys were there to try to secure the country and here comes Blackwater. This shows you what the president thinks about the armed forces, that he would call in a private security company to guard the oil.
And private security companies are guarding the CPA, the Coalition Provisional Authority, and now, obviously, the embassy.
So now he did, so essentially our nation's top leader doesn't trust the army. I mean, I don't understand that. I mean, what did you guys? I mean, and I'm just making that. I'm just thinking that. Surely I'm not the first one to have that thought.
I was confused. I mean, I was confused.
Have other guys expressed that over there, or that you've
sure.
had
especially? I mean, especially guarding the convoys, and just the way they operate. One time, one of the Halliburton KBR trucks got a flat tire, and they, I guess their civilian convoy commander didn't have the right wrench with him. So he decided, since I guess the American people are paying for that truck, just to torch it and get a new one. So, but if you're an American company commander and you have to torch one of your own vehicles because you forgot the right wrench, that's the end of your career. But the civilian fought, you know, lived to fight another day, I guess.
In Iraq right now, what's the sentiment among our soldiers? You know, are they content to remain there for a while? That the president has said that it's, you know, more than likely that it'll be the next president to pull us out of there to fix it or to clean up the mess or to whatever. Do you think that we're prepared to remain there for another, what's this, 2006, another 3 years?
I mean, the spirit of the American military is strong. But nonetheless, when guys are on their third tour, their fourth tour, it takes a toll. It takes a toll on them. It takes a toll on their families. And, you know, we're in a tough spot right now. I can't speak for the soldiers there right now. I mean, people, you focus on the missions you have today and protecting your buddies, but we're under a lot of strain.
Is that strain creating issues? Is that strain creating problems? You know, I don't want to say like mental problems, but I mean, you know, the stress and combat fatigue that, you know, can create a lot of issues in people. And I mean, have you seen a lot of that kind of like hair trigger kind of mentality, or any of the, you know, the symptoms of a PTSD suffering soldier?
Sure. I think I'm pretty positive I had symptoms of PTSD when I came home.
Really?
I didn't realize it at the time. And there wasn't any follow-up by the Army Reserve to see if I was okay. You know.
Have you been able to get some help? I hope you've gotten some help with that.
Just talking with my buddies, I think, is the best thing.
Really?
Best thing for me. And I'm fine. But nonetheless, there were some behaviors that weren't the best for me when I came home.
I work with, I have in the past worked with veterans and in a case management capacity in a nonprofit, veterans who have suffered from PTSD and a number of other things. And I think the one thing that seems to be common is that there is a sense that there's a sense that civilians don't really understand what it means to go into that kind of situation and what it means to be in a kill or be killed kind of atmosphere, you know, on a daily basis. And, you know, I commend you for, you know, not only for doing and serving your country in the way that you've served your country, but also for being forthcoming about the realities of what's going on over there. We have a situation that is highly political at this point. It was highly political to start with. And there are many people here who in years past probably would have condemned the American soldier, but are not doing that this time. Have you seen any, or have you perceived any condemnation on the part of the American public for any, you know, for any of this, as far as being a soldier?
No, not at all. And even like my both of my parents are virulently anti-war. I'm not anti-war. I want to see us win. I want to see the Iraqi people win. My parents had Cindy Sheehan over at the house before she became very famous, and they've been involved in all the anti-war rallies and just about anything they can get involved with. They support me, but they don't support the war.
Okay. Well, and that's kind of interesting that you say you are of course, being a soldier, I would expect you to, first of all, it's the idea that my buddy is there. We want to make sure that this is a positive outcome. At what point, given your experience as being there and seeing what's going on, at what point would you yourself say, you know what, it may be time for us to just go ahead and let those people be whatever they're going to be. What, you know, what do you think that there is that possibility that, that we may have bitten off more than we can chew?
It's hard, and that's not a question that my pay grade can handle.
I understand.
But nonetheless, I really think we have a moral obligation to the Iraqi people to do whatever is best for them. You know, people talk about the Pottery Barn rule, and it's the country's in bad shape, and we have a moral obligation to the Iraqi people.
Do they feel like we that? Or let me just ask that. What happened here? Something just happened. Anyway, do you feel that the Iraqi people are supporting us, the majority? Now, you know, yes, there's always going to be the minority of folks that are going to be the militants, and they're going to be, insurgents or whatever. Do you feel that the majority of the Iraqi people are behind us in trying to settle things down?
They want security. They want to feel safe on the street. They want some sense of normalcy for their family. And if that means that the American soldier brings that sense of normalcy, or if the Iraqi security forces bring that, I mean, that's what they want. They're tired. They're very tired. You know, they don't feel safe on the streets.
And I must say that I don't think that there's anyone in the United States that would want to be living in the kind of situation they're living in right now either. What do you think about the have you ever had any engagements with? With insurgents since when you were there?
Sure. I mean, well, just being in the prison, I met a lot of different insurgents.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting meeting them face to face and talking to them about why they hated America and why they took up arms against us.
Wow.
A lot of them were.
Did any of that enlighten you, or is it just sort of like, okay, yeah, that's just another, you know, or they're just crazy? How did you react to that stuff?
Well, I mean, it seems like they're reading a lot of propaganda.
Uh-huh.
Obviously, there's propaganda on both sides.
Sure, sure.
But I think when we finally got to meet face to face, you know, an American soldier and an Iraqi insurgent, we really saw that we're not even that much different. We're just people. For whatever reason, you know, somehow we ended up on the opposite side of this terrible conflict.
Tell me about what the future holds for you. Are you still on call to be called back into the Army? Are you completely out now? Or?
Well, I'm actually in law school right now, so but I do have a commitment until 2015 with the reserves. So
you might end up, who knows where you might, we may end up in China. Don't say that, man. Don't say that. You're a student at George Washington Law School. Are you intending to be an attorney, or what would you, what's your ambitions?
Well, I don't know. I'm interested in policy making, perhaps on the Hill.
Really? On the Democratic side or the Republican side?
Definitely on the Democratic side.
Okay. Now, you also, you know, I was reading in your bio that you said your mom actually had to purchase your body armor. What precipitated that?
Well, I got into Kuwait, and the body armor they had given us was Vietnam-era equipment that could not stop a round from an AK-47. And that's the most prevalent type of weapon up in Iraq. So I was worried, and I called my mother and said, "Hey, Mom, I need body armor. I need body armor that can stop an AK-47. She went on the internet and found it and shipped it right out to me.
There was a ruling that was made, I'm trying to remember, it was maybe 3 or 4 months, maybe longer, maybe 4 or 5 months ago, where the Department of Defense said that they were going to outlaw any private body armor, that all the body armor that was there or that was being supplied had to come from the U.S. government. Were you affected by that?
No. My situation happened well before that, before they were even issuing the effective body armor to everybody.
Okay.
So now I think uniformity is always important in the military, and I think they are getting the quality equipment out to the troops.
Sure.
So they do have a rationale behind that
So theory. Things have improved since all of the controversy about the plates, the armor plating not being in the personnel vehicles. You know, there's a whole string of stuff.
I mean, it took over a year to rectify all those problems.
How did you guys react to that one soldier standing up and saying to Donald Rumsfeld, you know, we're having to scrounge for glass. We're having.
I mean, I lived it. I lived it before mm-hmm. before he asked that question. So, you know, it was a moment of like it was a reality check for the you know it was the reality based community meeting the non reality based community. There's no more reality based community than the American military.
I hear you. Now you guys so you were cheering when he asked the question. You were like yes.
Sure. Let's do it.
Finally, how long did it take after that to actually get some of these things in place?
Getting the armor on the... By the time I left, we did have armored vehicles, but, you know, it took over a year
yeah.
to get everybody the body armor and get everybody the armored vehicles.
We're back. We have apparently reached a pretty ominous number. You want to talk about that?
2,500 killed in action.
Yeah,
killed in Iraq. It's unbelievable to me. And I, you know, people in my battalion were killed. And
did you have any buddies that have passed away or gotten killed over there?
A friend of mine was a member of my battalion. He was a gunner in the Humvee, kind of the same job I had. And he was hit with a RPG, and that was it. Father of two from San Diego, California.
Wow.
His wife was sick. He had gone home a little bit earlier, and he asked to stay home because it was for a hardship, and they denied it, and he had to come back. And then 2 weeks later,
wow.
he was killed in action. Yeah.
And what's bad is that there's 2,500 stories like that.
And for what? I want to see my dream that I'm not sure will ever happen would be to be invited back to Baghdad, you know, on the 50th anniversary or the 25th anniversary of the fall of Saddam Hussein and be welcomed as liberators and be thanked for our service. But at this rate, that's never going to happen. It's very sad.
Well, you know, that is absolutely. It's also we're also in a position where we need to. Honor those people, you know, those men and women who have given all, you know, in that regard. And this is one of those situations where it's so hard to differentiate. Everyone has an opinion, and everyone believes what's right and wrong about this. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, you know, I'm grateful. I'm glad that you are sitting here in front of me instead of being one of those guys, you know. And so thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for all you've done. Richard Murphy, who is... Now, what was your rank?
I was a specialist, about as low ranking as you can get.
You were a grunt.
Or a full bird private, they call us.
Full bird private. I hear you, bud. So thank you for joining me on the Bruce Birch program. Let me give you a card, and
right.
Definitely, you know, that's your prize. Yeah. But thank you for joining me, and, you know, I'd love to get you back on again sometime. And you know, I think it's exceedingly important that we get the truth out and that people who are out there living their lives understand better about what you guys are going through over there, because they need to know, absolutely, the unvarnished truth.
That's what IAVA.org is doing.
Okay.
Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. We're spreading the gospel from the troops who've lived it.
So it's the website is IAVA.org.
Yes, sir.
Is there any other way people can get in touch with you?
That's the preferred method.
Okay.
Pretty girls can give me a call. No.
I don't see a wedding ring. So. Well, thanks so much, Richard. Thanks
All
for
right,
joining
sir.
Me.
Thank
okay.
you so much.
Okay. And that was Richard Murphy of the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, and he joined us here on this fantastic afternoon at the Washington Hilton at the Take Back America conference, and wonderful stories, and really gave me a good understanding of some of what the veterans there have and soldiers there have dealt with. You are listening to the Bruce Birch Radio program. If you'd like to get in on the show, you have to do it tomorrow, because I've got so many interviews lined up today that it looks like we're going to have Jody Thompson on next, and Jody is with Culture RX. But if you want to get in on the radio program, You'll have to do that tomorrow. Give me an email if you want to do that. Bruce@BruceBurch.com. You're listening to the Bruce Burch Radio Program being brought to you by the Head On Radio Network.
This is Quality News Network. In a surprise move, President Bush flew to Iraq overnight, arriving this morning for face-to-face meetings with Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, who was notified just 5 minutes before Mr. Bush's arrival. The president had been scheduled to conduct those meetings from Camp David over a video teleconference hookup. Coinciding with the president's trip to Baghdad, Iraq has formally notified the U.N. Security Council that it wants the U.S.-led multinational force to remain in place for now because Iraqi troops and police are not yet ready to ensure security on their own. A resolution adopted by the Security Council to extend the force's mandate through the end of this year is scheduled to be reviewed next week. At least 70,000 coalition forces, most of them Iraqi, are being deployed on the streets of Baghdad in a massive effort to bring security to the Iraqi capital. They'll be enforcing checkpoints as well as an overnight curfew and will be wearing new uniforms to distinguish them from insurgents who wear fake uniforms and carry out attacks. More violence in Iraq today, a series of suicide attacks that left 32 people dead and dozens more wounded in Kirkuk. The explosions targeting police commandos, police stations, and patrols, as well as a busy food market. Tropical storm Alberto made landfall today in northwest Florida, bringing with it heavy rains and winds and some coastal flooding, but less damage than had been expected. There is word today that presidential adviser Karl Rove will not be charged by special counsel Patrick Fitzgerald in connection with the CIA leak case. An Israeli investigation concludes that the explosion on a Gaza beach that killed 7 people last Friday was caused by explosives planted there by Palestinian militants, not artillery fire from an Israeli Navy gunboat. In Gaza today, 11 people were killed, 9 of them civilians, in an Israeli missile strike on a van that Israel claims was carrying militants and rockets in Gaza. It's the deadliest such attack in nearly 4 years. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas calls it state terrorism. The United States today recognized the independence of Montenegro, helping cement the international community's acceptance of a referendum last month in favor of its breakaway from a union with Serbia. Diplomats in Vienna report that non-aligned states will back Iran's right to nuclear fuel production at a UN meeting this week, unmoved by U.S. calls to join efforts to get Tehran to stop enriching uranium. The U.S. government today reasserted its right to develop weapons for use in outer space to protect its military and commercial satellites and ruled out any global negotiations on a new treaty to limit them, as is being urged by China and Russia. And the European Union plans to use a summit with Mr. Bush next week to press for the closure of Guantanamo Bay detention camp.
Divorce is never a pleasant experience, but it doesn't have to be a tragedy. If you can rein in the emotions, step back from the anger and victimhood, you can end your marriage with dignity instead of hostility. You married with the best of intentions. Now you need to untie the marital knot with the same mutual respect. Choose collaboration instead of confrontation. Stop wasting money on lawyers. Don't drag this out for 5 years. A collaborative divorce is better for the children, family, and friends. Collaboration costs a fraction of a contended divorce and can be done within weeks rather than the months or marriage, fairly and efficiently. For less than what a lawyer charges to answer one simple question, you can get all the answers from divorce, collaborative style. Go to collaborativedivorce.tv and order your DVD today. If it's over, end it right. collaborativedivorce.tv.
Inflation at the wholesale level slowed in May after two big months of increases, even though gas prices and inflation pressures outside of energy and food continued to climb. The government's producer price index was up just 0.2% last month, better than economists had been expecting. However, the 12-month rise in the overall reading is now up 4.5%. A U.S. consumer group is suing the owner of the KFC chain, trying to force it to stop using trans fat and switch to a healthier cooking oil, or else to prominently warn consumers about the health hazard. Researchers report that drinking coffee cuts the risk of cirrhosis of the liver from alcohol by 22% per cup each day, but they stopped short of saying doctors should prescribe coffee for that reason. The report from California's Kaiser Permanente Medical Care Program was based on data from over 125,000 people. Price of gas is on the rise again, up nearly a cent and a half a gallon last week. It's up 78 cents a gallon from a year ago. A new manpower survey shows that employers expected no significant changes in their rates of hiring for the next 3 months, but construction employment is edging down slightly. And a new U.S. law to deter American consumers from seeking bankruptcy protection made filings plunge to a 20-year low the first quarter of this year, but there's been a rapid rise in new cases ever since. Light sweet crude oil is trading down at $68.45 a barrel this hour. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 9 points, NASDAQ is down 2, and the S&P 500 is off by 3. More at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Diana Walter. It's now 5 minutes past the hour.
The Head On Radio Network is brought to you every night by the Carpenters and Millwrights. The Mid-Atlantic Regional Council of Carpenters is a portion of the United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Joiners of America, or more commonly called the Carpenters Union. The millwrights are a very specialized craft that perform their work with highly sensitive equipment and perform much of their work on machinery like turbines, laser alignment, and other highly specialized tools. We would like to thank the Carpenters and Millwrights for their support, because freedom of speech is free, and it's brought to you by the Carpenters and Millwrights, working hard every day to provide a brighter future. Thank you from the Head On Radio Network.
You're back on the Bruce Birch Radio program, being brought to you by the Head On Radio Network and also by the West Virginia District Council of Carpenters and Millwrights. And sitting in front of me is, before I do that, if you want to get in touch with me, you can do you can send me an email to bruce@brucebirch.com. You can also visit my website at brucebirch.com. We're not taking calls today because mainly what we're doing is we're doing some wonderful interviews with just some fantastic, innovative people. If you hear a lot of noise in the background, it's, oh my goodness, Joe Wilson is walking right in front of the table. So, hi Joe. Hello Valerie. There you go. Celebrity row. Sitting with me today is a celebrity in her own right, and that is Jody Thompson. Jody is the innovator, the instigator, perhaps, of a new method, if you will, of working, of presenting how to run a business. And I just wanted to, before we get too far going, Jody, explain to me exactly what it is about this, or tell us what it is, and then explain to us why is it innovative.
Well, Bruce, I'm really excited to be here today because we have a very exciting thing to talk about, and that is something called a results-only work environment. And the reason why it's revolutionary is because it is absolutely flexibility on steroids. It's 100% do whatever you want, whenever you want, mm-hmm. as long as the work gets done.
Mm-hmm. And that is, oh my gosh, I mean, you know, I love to work. I'm a workaholic, or I should say a liveaholic, because that's all I do. But, you know, one would think, though, that people would, if given the choice, wouldn't go to work if they didn't have to, right?
You know, it's really interesting. People want to add value in all areas of their life, and we think that if you give people that kind of freedom, they'll just want to sit back and put their feet up. But people have purpose, and they want to add value to things, and so that thought that people aren't going to do the work is exactly the opposite of what happens.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Now, you worked for Best Buy.
Yes.
And while you were there, this is this R-O-W-E, Row. Is that how you
yes,
would
it
pronounce
is.
It?
Mm-hmm.
You developed this while you were there with a friend, with a business partner? Or?
Yes, actually, we were employees at Best Buy, and we like to say that this idea came from the bowels of corporate America. And actually, some people say, well, then it's a bowel movement, right? And well, not really. But it did start with us sitting kind of in the middle and looking around and taking the voice of the people and people saying, you know, I don't feel trusted mm-hmm. in the work environment. I don't feel supported.
Mm-hmm.
And really, there's a ton of programs that are trying to help people with flexibility, and these programs are really just Band-Aids.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the theory behind this. I mean, you know, you guys developed it. You were sitting around, and you said, okay, you wanted this to be a flexible work environment. Why did you want it to be flexible?
Well, you know, that's what people are asking for. I mean, that's important today, especially when you're thinking about Gen Y coming into the workplace.
Yes.
They cut their teeth on technology. They have different aspirations. They're going to change jobs 19 times in their career. They're going to quit their job to go
wow.
on a trip mm-hmm. if their employer doesn't let them have that freedom and opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not going to be as loyal to career, and I think if we're going to get the talent in the future, we have to start thinking about how do they work. I mean, think about yourself. You know what a typewriter is, right?
Absolutely.
You had one of those?
I did indeed.
Yes, a typewriter, mimeograph machines, the little pink pads ka-chunk, that say
ka-chunk, ka-chunk,
exactly.
Ka-chunk.
You know, they say, what is it? They don't know what a dial phone is. They don't know these pieces of equipment. They come into the work environment and there's a desktop computer. They're like, what's that? Well, this is where you sit. It's a box, and then you sit there all day, and we expect you to be productive. It just doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm. And so what you're illustrating, of course, is moving from one paradigm to the next.
Absolutely. It's an absolute paradigm shift. You know, people think about corporate America. It has its own culture.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big office building. I work in a cube. I go to a lot of meetings. I come in at 8 and I leave at 5. And anything outside of that really doesn't fit in how we think about corporate work.
Mm-hmm.
So if I say I want to go and, you know, have lunch with my child, I have to ask permission. Or if I want to leave the workplace at 3 o'clock, I'm going to get stigmatized for leaving early. Well, in a results-only work environment, you get to do whatever you want whenever you want as long as the work gets done. And leaving at 3 o'clock is meaningless because we do work at night and on weekends and whenever as long as the work gets done.
So let's just say that somebody like myself who likes to stay up until 2 o'clock in the morning, would it be okay for me to go into work at 2 in the or at midnight to work, and work till 2 to get some things done and then come in later in the morning?
Absolutely. In this environment, you don't think of corporate as 8 to 5 Monday through Friday anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So on a Sunday night, you wouldn't get that pit in your stomach. Oh, no, here comes the work week. Now I'm in jail again from 8 to 5. I'm treated like a child.
Right.
You decide moment by moment how to do your work.
Has this been implemented? And if so, where?
You know, this is working famously at our client site, Best Buy.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the corporate workplace, about 52% of the population.
Mm-hmm.
Around 2,000 people are operating in this environment. And
wow.
They are seeing an increase of about 35% in productivity. They're seeing engagement
increase. That's a huge increase.
It's huge. You know, you think just something simple. I don't sit in rush traffic. I'm actually doing work while everybody else is out there polluting the environment, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm home doing work.
Did it astonish you what astonishes me, when you first started getting results as far as, the percentage rate of increased productivity, did it surprise you?
It did surprise us because it was so out of the realm of what we expected. We knew people would get more productive, but how much more productive, like how high is high, we couldn't tell. Mm-hmm. But people are saying, I'm not only more productive, but the way that I think about how I operate on a daily basis has changed, and I'm closer to my family, and I'm closer to my kids, and I'm connecting more with other things in my life that I've wanted to do, friends from the past, and I'm still getting my work done, and I'm actually doing more work than I used to do.
So things like the Family Leave Act would be rendered perhaps obsolete under this kind of situation.
You know, the benefits of this environment are different than the traditional benefits. In a traditional work environment, you might get paid time off, you know, certain amount of vacation, different kinds of benefits. But in this environment, you get unlimited paid time off as long as the work gets done. Now think about that.
Wow. That would be wonderful.
As long as the work gets done. You just take time off when you need it.
How's
that?
You need to go to the beach on Friday. Go ahead.
You
just
go to the
beach. Make sure your work's done before you leave.
Right. And really, this environment creates very close relationships in the work environment. So when I'm at the beach, you have my back. And when you're out riding your mountain bike, I have your back. And that kind of sort of continual watching each other and making sure the customer serves, not in a cube, but by thinking about the results only. I need to serve the customer, and I do that any way I can. You know, I can be in the grocery store, and I can get a phone call. I can pick out, you know, frozen peas at the same time I'm taking care of a customer issue. Why not?
Sure.
The customer doesn't care if I'm in a cube or in the grocery store, as long as they get served. That's Roe.
Where do you see this going? Do you see this as a phenomenon that may spread nationwide? Are you working? I mean, do you get a lot of response from this? Or?
We absolutely do, Bruce. This is going to be a revolution over the next 30 to 50 years. It's going to change the face of how we think about work.
She said she was a revolutionary, folks, but she's sitting here in a very gorgeous dinner dress. So I said, even the revolution's going to be dressed up.
Yes, it is. It absolutely will look good all the way through. In fact, when you see your children, grandchildren, they're going to say, "Grandpa, you used to work in one of those cubes. Isn't that funny?" They're going to look at that as just something very odd.
Yeah.
50 years from now,
sure.
And we are really starting that change.
Mm-hmm.
And it will evolve, and companies will get on board, especially when they see that they're losing talent and they're not getting the talent that they need.
Now, this in corporate America, I can see that as working very well. What about in blue-collar America? Is there any way that we can adapt this kind of this method of working into that environment?
I absolutely think that you can. The thing is if you think about it this simply, we're all people on the planet doing work.
Mm-hmm.
And in any kind of work environment, people are sitting there knowing that they could be doing it better. But the rules and the regulations and the management style is keeping them boxed in. When you start infusing freedom, people come up with all sorts of great ideas. And that's good for the bottom line. It just is.
So by saying to the worker, we honor you enough to give you the freedom to do the things that you need to do and to be able to take care of your family and take care of yourself and create a new reality for yourself. By saying that to the worker, they'll turn around and say, you know what, I really respect that. And as a result, what I will do is honor you again. So this is more about honoring. This is more about respect and about honoring the human spirit more than anything else, isn't it?
It absolutely is, and it's 100% trust. It's trust from the manager to the employee to their colleague. I mean, you really have to trust people and start out with the thought that people want to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody's going to cheat, and people are going to band together and pull together. And that's what happens in this environment. It's absolute trust.
Well, you know, it sounds like a really wonderful thing. Now, tell me about Culture RX. This is your consulting company, or is this? Tell me about the company.
It absolutely is. It's our consulting company. We started it while we were at Best Buy.
Mm-hmm.
Best Buy actually thinks it's a very good idea. They foster forward thinking and innovation. So, with their blessing, we started our own consulting business. And now we're looking for other Fortune 200 companies to get on board.
a little noisy here, isn't it?
It's fun, though. I love the energy.
We are surrounded by a who's who of the Washington left. I mean, I'm looking around
everywhere.
Me, and I'm going, oh, my God, look at the people here. It's just,
yep,
wow.
It's energy.
Your company, what's your plan as far as how you want to inject this into the working environment? Do you feel like this is something that, or have you written, do you have a book out that...
We do not have a book yet, but uh-huh. I would encourage people to visit the website because it really talks a lot about the philosophy, mm-hmm. which is culturerx.com, culturerx.com.
Culturerx.com, and I've already been to the website. Pretty snazzy website, by the way.
It's a little bit edgy.
Joe Wilson's standing over your shoulder right now.
Should I look or not?
No, don't look.
Okay.
He's got his fingers up behind your head.
Yeah, I'm sure he does. It's the peace sign.
It's the peace. Yeah, there you go. Any last thoughts? What would you like to convey? I mean, this is a really positive shift in corporate America and in the idea that, you know, by honoring each other, we can create a new reality and support each other as well, financially as well as in other ways. Do you see this as something that's going to take off very quickly?
I think it's going to take a while, but it will take off. I mean, it's time for this kind of revolution. We've been talking about flexible work arrangements for years and years and years, and it doesn't work. I mean, it's time for a change, and it's time for changing the game, something radical that's really going to serve people and serve business. This is
sure.
it.
Well, I certainly wish you all the best of luck with this, and I think it's fantastic. You need to come down to North Carolina and where I'm from. And do some pushing in there.
Oh, I'd love to do that.
But thank you so much for joining me. Is there anything else you would like to impart?
I would say it's really important that we continue to focus on what's really important for people, and that's family, community, really supporting each other. And this environment is a catalyst to that. It's not just about work, but it's about how we treat each other. And I think that's why it's going to gain momentum. It's what people are looking for.
Okay. Well, I totally agree with you because, you know, for me, I think it's, you know, I'd like to be able to work whenever I want to. And I think I'd probably work, I'd end up working more hours than they would want. They'd be like, Bruce, you need to go home, man. It's, you know, you've been here for 10 hours already. Yes, but I got this project, you see. And that's the other idea that I want, maybe before we close up, the other idea I want to throw at you, or maybe based in what you're talking about with this, is it possible to move even a further shift with using this to more of a project-based kind of atmosphere rather than just, do you follow, or rather than, sell, you know, so that, okay, well, as long as you've hit these benchmarks on the project, you're good for this week?
It actually does work. We have a whole project management group that has gone through this migration.
Okay.
And what they're doing now is they're thinking about project management in a different way. You might think of project management in how many hours it takes to do something and how much time you spend against a project.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not about activities. It's about the outcome in the end. So they're starting to shift their thinking in a more positive direction, and that's making them more efficient and more energized. I mean, you talked about your passion. You love to do what you do, right?
Absolutely.
But if I told you how you needed to do it, would you love that?
No.
Right. Because you know the best way to do it.
That's very true. That's very true. Jody, thank you so much for joining me today. Jody Thompson of Culture RX, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me here today, Bruce.
All right. And I certainly hope you enjoy the gala dinner.
I will.
I'll be working, so think about me.
I'm going
right?
to go to the cocktail hour now.
Okay. Don't come out. Bring your cocktail back.
Yeah, well, don't I wish I could.
It'll be a much more interesting conversation.
Yes, it would. It would go a whole different direction. Thanks, bro.
Okay, thank you so much. And that was Jody Thompson of Culture RX, and she has created a new way to work called ROWE, Results Only Work Environment. Thank you for joining me. And this is the Bruce Birch Radio Program. I did want to... give you a heads up, you know, the cocktail hour is going on right behind me, and you know, if you heard all the wonderful noise in the background there, it was the meeting and greeting time. So we are about to come up on a hard break, and we're going to take that break now, and we'll come back right after that. You are listening to the Bruce Birch Radio Program, being brought to you by the Head On Radio Network and the West Virginia District Council of Carpenters and Millwrights. We'll be right back.
Straight. Howdy, this is Baxter Black. And if you're like me, you're concerned that the environment we enjoy today may not be around for our children and grandchildren. All the new technology in the world can't create more sky over our heads or new oceans. The Earth's natural resources, fresh water, land, and even the air we breathe are limited. Voluntary family planning improves the health of women and their children. It also helps slow population growth, which is good for our planet. So help ensure that people everywhere have access to the information and services they need to plan their families and help build a healthy future for us all. Population Action International is working to promote voluntary family planning around the world. Visit us at www.populationaction.org. That's populationaction.org.
In society where there's diversity, we all learn from each other in the sense of understanding each other's beliefs and cultures in society, respecting that.
When you meet people who are different from you, the biggest thing you can do is learn from them.
There's a long way to go for disabled people to feel part of a larger community. And I'm starting to feel like I'm included, especially in the university setting.
I don't put the responsibility completely to other people, but I think I had a responsibility to feel included. That's what has made me a difference in my life.
A little niceness can go a long way, one life at a time, one person at a time. We will make a difference.
We were studying Martin Luther King Jr., and one of his quotes was, "We must learn to live together as brothers and sisters, or perish together as fools."
Together, I know we will make a difference.
To find out how you can make a difference, visit helpmakeadifference.com. This message is brought to you by the Government of Alberta and Global Television.
Hello, may I help you?
Hello, can I ask a few questions about the apartment you have on Park Street?
What was your name?
My name is Juan Hernandez.
It's been rented.
Oh, it's gone?
Hello?
Hello, my name is Sanjay Kumar. I am calling about the apartment on Park Street.
It's not available.
It's not available, but I just now saw it in the paper.
May I help you?
Hi, my name is Tyrone Washington. I'm calling about a place to rent on Park Street.
No longer available.
Oh, it's not available now.
Nope, sorry.
Oh, okay.
Hello?
Yes, hello. My name is Graham Wellington. I'm calling about the apartment for rent on Park Street. Is that still available?
Yes, it is.
Oh, it is?
Yes.
Oh, really? I'd love to make an appointment.
Housing discrimination is illegal. If you think you've been a victim because of your race, color, national origin, sex, religion, disability, or family status, call 800-669-9777 or visit fairhousinglaw.org. Fair housing. It's not an option. It's the law. Brought to you by HUD, the Ad Council, and LCCREF.
Back on the Bruce Birch radio program. This is Bruce Birch, your host, and I am coming to you live from the Take Back America conference being held at the Washington Hilton in Washington, D.C. We do have with us now, you know, we've had, just some incredible guests thus far. We're about halfway through the radio program, and the next guest that we have is Greg Speeder, and Greg is the executive director of the National Priorities Project. And, Greg, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks, Bruce. I'm glad to be here.
Well, we're glad you're here. Tell me about the National Priorities Project, what you guys do and what it's all about.
Okay, I'll be glad to do that. We've been around for about 20 years. We began back in the 1980s when we were trying to work, we were working with community groups. I've been doing a lot of community organizing, a lot of policy work, trying to make sure that federal budget had was being responsive to local communities, and we found that in our communities a lot of programs are being cut. People were losing health care, people were losing education programs, and it was all a part of the Reagan budget shift, but people really didn't have a clue as to what was going on in their local community, what it really meant.
Really?
And so what we did is we analyzed this information. We thought we could get the information from the federal government because they used to tell communities how much money was coming back from the federal government. And
sure.
We found out by 1985 that kind of information didn't exist. So if you don't know what you're getting from the federal government, you don't know what you're losing. So we did our own research and found out that in one congressional district, and we've got about 435 of them across the country, in one congressional district, the congressional district had lost $54 million in the first 3 years of the Reagan administration.
$54 million? In one district?
In one district. And interestingly enough, it happened to be in the district of the ranking Republican on the Appropriations Committee, and he didn't realize that. As a matter of fact, it took him a while to even want to meet with us because he didn't believe our numbers. And then his staff actually spent 3 or 4 weeks researching and found out that we were right. It's very interesting that if the ranking Republican on the Appropriations Committee, the committee that dispenses the money out to all the congressional districts, doesn't know the impact, then who does know? And so what we have done really since then is to work with a number of different organizations and a number of different campaigns trying to help people realize what's going on with various federal policies in the federal budget and if their communities or the states are winning or losing on these policies.
So in a word, a lot of what you do is to arm organizations with knowledge about how to go with knowledge that does help organize people. Because, you know, obviously if you're in a district and you realize that, you know, your library system or whatever it is,
yeah.
you know, your security is going to be cut, you know, by a significant amount of money, that really does bring people out of the woodwork because dollars and cents is hard knowledge.
Well, that's exactly what we do. I mean, it's really a way to hold your elected official accountable. It's probably mm-hmm. the only way to do that because we've got the numbers there. And so, yeah, it's been very useful. People use this information to meet with their elected officials. They use this information to educate the media.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes, the media is trying to find out the local angle on the federal budget when it's released in February.
Mm-hmm.
But we've got some numbers that can show them, you know, what's being cut in or increased in community development or taxes or military spending, what have you. So it's a way to really understand, you know, people think that the federal budget is so big, which it is.
It's huge.
And so far away and so corrupt, and there's some truth to all of that, that there's nothing they can do. And that's the part that isn't true because there is things that they can do. With this information, people can really make a difference.
Give us some real-life examples. Actually, before you do that, you know, what motivated you as the executive director? I guess you're probably also the founder, right?
That's right.
What motivated you to want to do this?
Well, you know, I started out my activist years in the mid-60s, part of the civil rights movement, the part of the war on poverty movement.
Were you one of those hippies, man?
Well, believe it or not, I didn't let my hair grow too long because I wanted to be able to communicate with the other side.
There you go.
And so, but what I did do is I spent a lot of time in one low-income neighborhood, about 4.5, 5 years, helping that neighborhood really pick itself up by its bootstraps, really mm-hmm. begin to organize itself,
sure.
use its own leadership. And I really saw the neighborhood turn itself around. By the mid-70s and the late 1970s, they had really effective housing programs. The unemployment rate was down. The poverty rate was down. People had made a difference, and one of the major reasons why is that they had some resources to do something with that leadership, and those resources came from the federal government. They provided housing money so that people could develop housing programs. They provided incentives for people to make changes in schools and so on. And it was in 1980, 1981, when the Reagan administration came in, it cut those programs. And
right.
So my motivation was to say, wait a minute, if we really want to deal with needs in communities, at that time poverty, education, and so on, you know, you've got to give people some opportunity. And those programs, the very programs that were making a difference, were being cut. So
I remember Mitch Snyder here in Washington, D.C., going
right.
on a hunger strike
Absolutely.
For the homeless. I mean, that, you know, one of my own personal passions is working with the homeless.
Mm-hmm.
It always
mm-hmm.
has been.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was, you know, Reagan's vision that that the faith-based communities and that, of course, they didn't call them that then,
yeah.
but the religious communities and the, you know, private social services would be the ones to take over this nationwide disgrace rather than the federal government stepping up to the bat.
Yeah.
And as a result, hundreds of people, thousands of people were turned out into the streets. How are you able to communicate to service providers or people in local communities? You know, let's say for instance a community in say Washington D.C. or New York has Department of Homeland Security money's cut. How do you have local chapters that you communicate that to that help get the word out? Or how does that happen?
Let me answer that in a second, but let me just go back to your housing thing because I don't want to forget that because, you know, housing is also one of my concerns.
Sure.
And I saw what was happening. And if you take a look at the numbers, what happened either nationally and locally, and we've got both numbers.
Sure.
There were dramatic cuts during the Reagan administration.
There were.
So it wasn't as though there was a problem and the Reagan administration said, well, maybe the faith-based community would solve it. They helped create that problem. We spent about a third to a quarter of what we were spending in 1980 in housing assistance. So, you know, people just couldn't afford the housing, and those cuts in housing were a part of the homeless the whole situation.
Absolutely.
So how do we work with other organizations around Homeland Security, for example, or some of the other issues? Well, we do a lot of work with a number of national organizations, especially those with local chapters. So going back to 1989 and 1990, we work with the National Income Housing Coalition. Using local numbers, we found out how many people were homeless in a variety of different cities, put out a variety of different reports, and brought people together to Washington to help pass one of the housing acts. So that national coalition brought its people here to Washington to help make change. We try to keep in contact with national organizations. We've got staff people who are at a conference like this and a variety of other conferences working with some of the major movement kinds of issues that are going on. So, you know, we've done work around organizations that focused on schools falling apart. We've done work around low-wage jobs with a number of the labor unions. Mm-hmm. We work a lot with the peace community around what's going on with the war in Iraq, and as a matter of fact, have managed to be able to calculate how much the war is costing a number of different cities.
Sure.
So people, you know, so those numbers make a difference. They really mean something to people.
Give me a real life example of some of those numbers that we've been talking about.
Well, I can. I know that you're doing some work in the Southeast, so let me just say the war is costing South Carolina $2.4 billion. It's costing Charleston.
Is that per year?
That's for the 3 years.
Or, so that's total.
That's
numbers,
right. That's right.
Which has probably changed since you just said that.
Well, it could be because one of the things that we've got on our website is a counter that shows how much we spend, and it's just a continual change and change and change. And you can embed that information on your own website. So if you go to the www.
So there's like a feed that we can.
That's right. You can go to costofwar.com, and people do that for their own cities, and it's pretty amazing. But the city of Charleston, $56 million. The Columbia, South Carolina, $59 million. If we've got any folks here from Tennessee.
Is Monkey Junction, North Carolina, on the list?
You know, we... We don't have it on there yet, but if it's a census tract, if there's census data, we can get it.
Well, apparently, I think it is actually a real town. I don't know why, but it is a real town. I haven't yet figured that one out. Let's look at let me see the list here.
Okay.
I want to look up. Let's see. Let's just take a quick. I'm flipping through the list.
We have
let's
a list
look
of
at Beckley. Beckley West is Beckley. Okay, it says Berkeley, but I bet that's supposed to be Beckley, West Virginia.
Could be.
How much has the war cost West Virginia and Beckley, West Virginia?
Well, whole state, $893 million. Beckley, $48 million. Charleston, $30 million. I'm not sure if there are any cities that you know. Braxton, $6 million. Calhoun, $2.7 million. Some of these are smaller cities, obviously. I live in a small town in Massachusetts, 3,000 people, about $5 million.
About $5 million.
Yeah.
3,000 people, $5
million. Yeah, 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 yeah.
So when you translate that down, all right, let's break it all the way down to the person.
Yeah.
Do you have that number?
We have some of that information on our website. Actually, we do have per household. It's for household, it's average $2,819 per household. Per person, $1,065.
So if every household was to come up with $2,819, well, let's ask the question.
Okay.
And the question would be, do you and your household believe that it was worth your $2,819 to invade Iraq?
Well,
and I'll speak for my household. Hell no. but
well, and I think that's been the general consensus for a number of months, and from some places for a number of years.
And these numbers that we've been talking, if you just tuned in, these numbers we're talking about are the cost of the war of Iraq for various individual communities. And I was just signaling my assistant to try to get Ambassador Wilson a card. Let's look at some other things. Now, how do federal policies impact our community? And one of the things that you have looked at is the impact of the president's budget on our state.
That's right.
Or any state.
Yeah.
You are really crunching a lot of numbers.
Well, we are. We have probably more numbers than people could really be able to use, but we encourage them to use as much information as possible. We have put together a database, and it's really interactive. There's some fun ways to use our database. For instance, you can go on and type in how much you paid in taxes on our website. We won't look. We don't care. But we will tell you how much of that tax dollar...
The NSA might.
Yeah, well, we hope not. But we will tell you how much goes to housing, how much goes to health care, how much goes to the military, how much goes to job training, things like that. And it's really pretty, I mean, percentage-wise, I can just give you just a sense of where your tax dollar goes. The average person in tax dollars, if job training is important, if jobs are important, you should know that 0.3 cents of every tax dollar goes to job training. Only 2 cents out of every tax dollar goes to housing, 4 cents to education, but 19 cents out of every tax dollar goes to interest on the national debt. And that's gone up since we've provided tax breaks for very wealthy people. 29 cents out of every tax dollar goes to the military. So, you know, you add up the military and you add up the interest on the debt, that's, that's about 48 cents out of every tax dollar going not back to your community. 20 cents out of every tax dollar goes to health care, but we've got 45 million people without health insurance. Mm-hmm. Something's wrong with that. So we're trying to bring some of that down to the local level so that people can understand what that really means to people. And, then the average person, we've got some information here on Baltimore, Maryland, for instance. The average household only spends $4 on job training. They spend $370 on the military.
Sure.
Other families obviously spend a lot more, and we've talked about that. But
what are your plans to? Do you have plans to expand what you're doing to encompass more things, or do you want to focus on what just the federal budget?
Well, I think what we want to be able to do is provide more information and more ways to make the federal budget more real.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to work with more organizations that are working on these issues. One of the things that we're going to be opening up probably this September is information on we have a trade-offs feature. And we want to bring that down to the congressional district level so that you can go in, type in your zip code, probably. You'll be able to type in your zip code. We'll tell you what congressional district you're in, and we'll tell you how much the congressional district pays for the war, how much tax breaks for the richest 1% cost your tax.
That'd be great.
Your congressional district.
Yeah.
And we'll tell you what else you could buy instead. How many people, would that provide health care for? How many schools would that build? How many teachers would that provide? Would that provide you? You can already get that information at the state level,
mm-hmm.
On our website. So you can go in and we'll tell you that information by state. But, to bring it down to the congressional district level, again, kind of brings it back down to those who make the decisions. And it's a way to hold elected officials accountable.
And we need to do more of that, holding them accountable, that is.
Well, we absolutely do. And we think local numbers is the way to do that. And, I'm really glad to be at this event. There are a couple thousand people here at least who are really trying to make a difference in their community. But you go into local communities and people do feel a sense of powerlessness, that there's nothing you can do. And I think what's encouraging about this forum here at the Take Back America conference is that you can see that people are making a difference and things are changing. And I think that's encouraging. And I think the reason we're here is to help make sure that organizations know about our local data as a way to help them become more powerful.
Okay. We're going to go ahead and take a quick break, Greg, and we'll be back. But this is you're listening to the Bruce Burks Radio Program being brought to you by the Head On Radio Network live from the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C., and I got to tell you, there is a hubbub going on behind me, isn't it, Greg?
It really is.
It's really incredible.
Yeah, and that's been going on for the last 2 days.
It has been, and actually, you know, actually it's been really quiet right here, but back there it's pretty noisy.
Yeah.
We may have to flip the table around just so I can see what's going on back there. It's kind of funny. All right, but we will be right back here in just a minute. You listen to Bruce Burch.
Last Fourth Estate, we heard from Robert Fisk.
What has now become a habit of compromising on the semantics of reporting in order to avoid criticism. You know, if you call a Jewish settlement or neighborhood a colony, you'll be criticized and called potentially anti-Semitic.
And a little bit of activist history and the Red Scare.
On the line with us right now, we have Kate Fossil, biographer of Anne Braden.
You know, I got interested in Anne's life because of her being a white Southern voice against racism. And
leave it to our listeners to ring up and keep it light.
I don't either. And, you know, Bruce is concerned about the remote control for his DVD player. I mean, I'm thinking about getting rid of the remote control on my blow-up doll. I mean, you know.
What's his name?
I never kiss and tell.
FourthEstateRadio.com.
This is Bruce Burch, and I'd like to invite you to join me for a brand new show here on the Horn, the Bruce Burch Radio Program. Tune in Monday through Friday, 5 to 7 p.m. Eastern, right here on the Head On Radio Network.
The Head On Radio Network is brought to you every night by the Carpenters and Millwrights. The Mid-Atlantic Regional Council of Carpenters is a portion of the United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Joiners of America, or more commonly called the Carpenters Union. The Millwrights are a very specialized craft that perform their work with highly sensitive equipment and perform much of their work on machinery like turbines, laser alignment, and other highly specialized tools. We would like to thank the Carpenters and Millwrights for their support, because freedom of speech is free. And it's brought to you by the Carpenters and Millwrights, working hard every day to provide a brighter future. Thank you from the Head On Radio Network.
Back on the Bruce Burch Radio Program being brought to you by the Head On Radio Network. If you're interested in our website, please visit us. There's a couple of websites I'll shoot to you here real quick. The first one is headonradionetwork.com, where you will find chat room and blog posting and just all kinds of neat interactive stuff to get involved in. The second one is my own website, brucebirch.com. That's my online home. You can go there and, again, see whatever you want to see there. Interesting stuff. So we're real grateful to have you with us here today. I do have sitting in with me Greg Speeder, who is he's with the National Priorities Project. And Greg joined me this afternoon to talk about some of the priorities that we do have around the nation. And one of those priorities that he was going to talk about next was our national security.
Well, I'm bringing that up because, you know, one of the things that we've been trying to do is to find different ways to make our federal government more responsive to our communities, to make sure that people have access to health care, decent jobs, and things like that. And they always say there's not enough money. And one of the reasons, the two reasons why. One is because they say that we're going into debt, and I think that, you know, one of the reasons behind that is our tax policy that cuts billions of dollars every year and gives it back to very wealthy people. And we can talk about that in a minute if you want. But
sure.
The other reason why we've been, you know, I've been doing this work for 40 years, and I remember during the War on Poverty, there was the Vietnam War, and then there was the Reagan administration, and then they cut more programs then. Then there was supposed to be a peace dividend, and the money never really came back then because we were able to retire much of the debt. And then came the Bush administration, and we've skyrocketed the Pentagon budget, and we've also continued to go more and more in debt with some of these tax cuts. So one of the things that we've been saying is there's going to be a way that we can provide security for us, but do we really need to spend as much money as we're spending? I don't know if you realize, Bruce, that we spend as much as the rest of the world combined. So of the 200 and some countries, out of all the military budgets of all those countries,
You mean we spend more than 200 countries, the rest of the world combined?
That's right.
What about China?
Well, China, I don't have the exact figures, but we are 6 or 7 times what China spends. We're well beyond what China, and their military is so unsophisticated compared to ours.
Well, where is the money going then?
Well, you know, that's a good question. We spend about $500 and some billion budget with the war. That's almost about over $500 billion. One of the things that people are really frustrated about is the fact that we're buying a lot of weapon systems that have nothing to do with terrorism. They're called Cold War weapons. We've got, for instance, this thing called the F-22 jet fighter.
Sure.
It's so sophisticated. It was created back in the early 1980s as a way to deal with the very sophisticated Soviet jet fighters, but the Soviet Union no longer exists. And yet we continue to build.
And there's no other country that has any planes that are that sophisticated.
Right, there aren't, and certainly not the Taliban. This is a jet fighter that can evade radar, and the Taliban doesn't have radar, and Al Qaeda doesn't have radar.
And we have jet fighters that can evade radar and the most advanced weapon systems in the world, but we can't find Osama.
That's right.
Who's 6 foot something
that,
and is on dialysis.
That's right. Well, so that's just one weapon system. And this jet fighter, one jet fighter, $330 million.
One jet fighter
could build 3,000 housing units.
I was going to say that's one third of the entire federal budget that was spent on the McKinney Act homelessness funding last year.
That's right.
One third.
One
jet.
So three jet fighters could have done the whole thing. So I think, you know, the next time you see a jet fighter, if it looks like an F-22, they haven't even gone into. But you can just visualize that's 3,000 housing units up there. So it's really frustrating, just the cost of that kind of a weapon system. Plus, you know, we've got Star Wars that isn't working. You know, that's $10 billion right there. We've got $17 billion in nuclear weapons. We're building more nuclear weapons.
Right.
If you added up all the money that we spend on national security,
mm-hmm.
Which includes some preventive money, not much, and some homeland security money, all that is really what we would call national security. So that's over $600 billion. Only one of those billions of dollars, $1 billion that we spend buying up nuclear weapons from the former Soviet Union. And those are the nuclear weapons that everybody agrees are potentially to get in the hands of a terrorist.
So and there's many missing over there right now.
Well, it's hard to keep on top of this stuff, you know. And why aren't we putting money into something like that? Why are we building jet fighters that have nothing to do with security? Why are we...
You want an easy answer? I can give you an easy answer because we have a current Republican administration that believes in rewarding cronyism.
Well, and that's exactly what's happening. We are buying weapon systems that not even the Pentagon wants. So, you know, it just doesn't make any sense.
So where are they doing with it? They're building these weapon systems and then selling them to other countries?
Well, sometimes that's the case. And then they get a weapon system, and it's a kind of sophisticated weapon system. So we say, well, maybe we need to build another weapon system to be able to make sure that we don't get attacked by that weapon system. So we end up in an arms race with ourselves.
That sounds very, I'm not going to say the word, but you know what I'm thinking, right? I don't know. It's not quite seven. After seven, I'll say the word. No, but it is. It's very much a self-flagellating right. kind of thing. And I guess what really surprises me more than anything else about what your work is doing is that before this there was no real breakdown, and the GAO didn't do a real breakdown.
Right, and that's what we're trying to be able to do. And we'll be able to show. We can show by state right now. And it's on our website, what some of these weapon systems are costing states. And hope to be able to do that by congressional district as well.
Are you working with the GAO, or do you have any how do you find out the numbers, and what do you have friendly senators or congressmen that help you do the work you're doing?
Well, actually, we have staff people that spend a lot of time reading a lot of GAO reports and other reports and sort of pull the pieces together. Mm-hmm. Once we know how much something costs at the national level, we've been able to use other kinds of data, treasury data and so on, to figure out how much